allow. As the mouth opened to speak, another one of the skinny humans, his rags slightly less tattered than those of the others, moved into Hawser's field of vision, just behind and to the side of the giant. The bell of head moved a few centimetres to one side and swivelled round, saying something to the man behind that Hawser couldn't catch. Then the giant raised his or her arms with obvious effort and gazed round the skinny humans gathered around Hawser. The voice sounded like congealing fat being poured into a jug. It was a drowning voice, Hawser thought, like something from a nightmare. He listened, but couldn't understand the language being used. He looked round to see what effect the giant's words were having on the famished-looking crowd. His head spun for a moment, as though his brain had shifted while his skull stayed still. He was suddenly back in the hangar of the clear air turbulence when the company had been looking at him, and he had felt as naked and vulnerable as he did now. "Oh, not again," he moaned in Moraine.
"Ooh-hoo,"
said the golden rolls of flesh, the voice tumbling over the slopes of fat in a faltering series of tones.
"Gracious, our bounty from the sea speaks."
The hairless dome of head turned further round to the man standing by its side.
"Mr. Fast, isn't this wonderful?" the giant burbled.
"Fate is kind to us, prophet," the man said gruffly.
"Fate favours the beloved. Yes, Mr. Fast. It sends our enemies away and brings us bounty. Bounty from the sea. Fate be praised."
The great pyramid of flesh shook as the arms went higher, trailing folds of paler flesh as the turret-like head went back, the mouth opening to expose a dark space where only a few small fangs glinted like steel. When the bubbling voice spoke again, it was in the language Hawser couldn't make out. But it was the same phrase repeated over and over again. The giant was quickly joined by the rest of the crowd, who shook their hands in the air and chanted hoarsely. Hawser closed his eyes, trying to wake from what he knew was not a dream. When he opened his eyes, the skinny humans were still chanting, but they were crowded around him again, blocking out his view of the golden brown monster. Their faces eager, their teeth bared, their hands stretched out like claws. The crowd of starving, chanting humans fell on him. They stripped off his shorts. He tried to struggle, but they held him down. In his exhaustion, he was probably no stronger than any one of them, and they had no difficulty pinning him. They rolled him over, pulled his hands behind him and tied him there. Then they tied his feet together and pulled his legs back until his feet were almost touching his hands and bound them to his wrists by a short length of rope. Naked, trussed like an animal ready for the slaughter, Hawser was dragged across the hot sand, past a weakly burning fire, then hauled upright and lowered over a short pole stuck into the beach, so that it ran up between his back and his tied limbs. His knees sank into the sand, taking most of his weight. The fire burned in front of him, sending acrid wood smoke into his eyes, and the awful smell returned. It seemed to come from various pots and bowls spread around the fire. Other fires and collections of pans were littered across the beach. The huge pile of flesh the man named Mr. First had called Prophet was set down near the fire. Mr. First stood at the obese human side, staring at Hawser through deep-set eyes contained within a pale and grubby face. The golden giant on the litter clapped chubby hands together and said,
"Stranger, gift of the sea, welcome. I am the great prophet Free Song."
The vast creature spoke a crude form of Moraine. Hawser opened his mouth to tell him his name, but Free Song continued,
"You have been sent to us in our time of testing, a mortal of human flesh on the tide of nothingness, a harvest thing plucked from the tasteless wash of life, a sweetmeat to share and be shared in our victory over the poisonous bile of disbelief. You are a sign from fate for which we give thanks."
Free Song's huge arms lifted up. Rolls of shoulder fat wobbled on either side of the turret-like head, nearly covering the ears. Fui Song shouted out in a language Hawser didn't know, and the crowd echoed the phrase, chanting it several times. The fat-smothered arms were lowered again.
"You are the salt of the sea, ocean gift."
Fui Song's syrupy voice changed back into Moraine once more.
"You are a sign, a blessing from fate. You are the one to become many, the single to be shared. Yours will be the gaining gift, the blessed beauty of transubstantiation."
Hawser stared, horrified at the golden giant, unable to think of anything to say. What could you say to people like this? Hawser cleared his throat, still hoping to say something, but Fui Song went on.
Be told, then, Gift of the Sea, that we are the Eaters. The Eaters of Ashes, the Eaters of Filth, the Eaters of Sand and Tree and Grass, the most basic, the most loved, the most real. We have laboured to prepare ourselves for our day of testing, and now that day is gloriously near.
The golden-skinned prophet's voice grew shrill. Folds of fat shook as Fui Song's arms opened out.
Behold us, then, as we await the time of our ascension from this mortal plane with empty bellies and voided barrels and hungry minds.
Fui Song's pudgy hands met in a slap, the fingers interweaved like huge, fattened maggots.
If I can, croaked Hawser,
but the giant was talking to the crowd of grubby people again, the voice bubbling out over the golden sands and the cooking fires and the dull, malnourished people. Hawser shook his head a little and looked out over the expanse of beach to the open-doored shuttle in the distance. The more he looked at the craft, the more certain he became it was a culture machine. It was nothing he could pin down, but he grew more certain with every moment spent looking at the machine. He guessed it was a 40 or 50-seater, just about big enough to take all the people he had seen on the island. It didn't look particularly new or fast, and it didn't look armed at all. But something about the whole way its simple, utilitarian form had been put together spoke of the culture. If the culture designed an animal-drawn cart or an automobile, they would still share something in common with the device at the far end of the beach, for all the gulf of time between the epochs each represented. It would have helped if the culture had used some sort of emblem or logo, but pointlessly unhelpful and unrealistic to the last, the culture refused to place its trust in symbols. It maintained that it was what it was and had no need for such outward representation. The culture was every single individual human and machine in it, not one thing. Just as it could not imprison itself with laws, impoverish itself with money, or misguide itself with leaders, so it could not misrepresent itself with signs. All the same, the culture did have one set of symbols it was very proud of, and Hawser didn't doubt that if the machine he was looking at was a culture craft, it would have some Moraine writing on or in it somewhere. Was it in some way connected with a mass of flesh still talking to the scrawny humans around the fire? Hawser doubted it. Fui Song's Moraine was shaky and ill-tutored. Hawser's own grasp of the language was far from perfect, but he knew enough about the tongue to realize Fui Song did it some violence when he, or she, used it. Anyway, the culture was not in the habit of loaning out its vehicles to religious nutcases. Was it here to evacuate them, then? Lift them to safety when the culture's high-technology shit hit the rotating fan that was the Vavatch orbital? With a sinking feeling, Hawser realized this was probably the answer. So there was no escape. Either these crazies sacrificed him or did whatever it was they were set on doing to him, or it was a ride into captivity, courtesy of the culture. He told himself not to assume the worst. After all, he now looked like Craiklin, and it wasn't that likely the culture's minds had made all the correct connections between him, the cat, and Craiklin. Even the culture didn't think of everything, but they probably did know he'd been on the hand of God 137. They probably did know he'd escaped from it. They probably did know that the cat was in that volume at the time. He recalled the statistics Zoralundra had quoted to the Hand's captain. Yes, the GCU must have won the battle. He remembered the cat's rough-running warp motors, probably producing a wake any self-respecting GCU could track from centuries away. Damn it, he wouldn't put it past them. Maybe they were testing everybody they were picking up from Vavatch. They would know in seconds from just a single sample cell, a skinflake, a hair. For all he knew, he'd been sampled already. A micromissile sent from the nearby shuttle picking up some tiny piece of tissue. He dropped his head, his neck muscles aching with all the others in his battered, bruised, exhausted body. Stop it, he told himself, thinking like a failure. Too damn sorry for yourself. Get yourself out of this. Still got your teeth and your nails? And your brain? Just bide your time.
For lo, Fui Song warbled. The godless ones, the most hated, the despised by the despised, the atheists, the anathematics, have sent us this instrument of the nothingness, the vacuum to us.
As the giant said those words, Hawser looked up and saw Fui Song point along the beach to the shuttle.
But we shall not waver in our faith. We shall resist the lure of the nothingness between the stars, where the godless ones, the anathematized of the vacuum, exist. We shall stay part of what is a part of us. We shall not treat with a great blasphemy of the material. We shall stand as the rocks and trees stand, firm, rooted, secure, staunch, unyielding.
Fui Song's arms went out again, and the voice bellowed out. The gruff-voiced man with the dirty pale skin shouted something at the seated crowd, and they shouted back. The prophet smiled at Hawser from across the fire. Fui Song's mouth was a dark hole, with four small fangs protruding when the lips formed a smile. They shone in the sunlight.
"This the way you treat all your guests?"
Hawser said, trying not to cough until the end of his sentence. He cleared his throat. Fui Song's smile vanished.
"Guest, you are not, sea wanton, salt gift, prize, ours to keep, mine to use, bounty from the sea and the sun and the wind, brought to us by fate."
Fui Song's smile returned with a girlish giggle, and one of the huge hands went to cover the pale lips.
"Fate recognizes its prophet and sends him tasty treats. Just when some of my flock were having second thoughts too, eh, Mr. First?"
The turret head turned to the thin figure of the paler man, standing with arms folded by the giant's side. Mr. First nodded.
"Fate is our gardener and our wolf. It weeds out the weak to honor the strong. So the prophet has spoken."
"And the word which dies in the mouth lives in the ear,"
Fui Song said, turning the huge head back to look at Hawser. At least, Hawser thought, now I know it's a male, for whatever that's worth.
"Mighty prophet,"
Mr. First said. Fui Song smiled wider, but continued looking at Hawser. Mr. First went on.
"The sea gift should see the fate that awaits him. Perhaps the treacherous coward, 27th.
"Oh, yes!"
Fui Song clapped his huge hands together and a smile lit up his whole face. For a second, Hawser thought he saw small white eyes beyond the slits staring at him.
"Oh, yes, let's bring the coward. Let us do what must be done."
Mr. First spoke in ringing tones to the emaciated humans gathered around the fire. A few stood up and walked off behind Hawser toward the forest. The rest started singing and chanting. After a few minutes, Hawser heard a scream, then a series of yells and screams gradually coming closer. At last, the people who had left came back, carrying a short, thick log, much like the one Hawser was held by. Swinging on the pole was a young man, screaming, shouting in the language Hawser didn't understand and struggling. Hawser saw drops of sweat and saliva fall from the young man's face and spot the sand. The log was sharpened at one end. That point was driven into the sand on the opposite side of the fire from Hawser, so that the young man faced the changer.
"This my libation from the seas," Fui Song said to Hawser, pointing at the young man, who was quivering and moaning, his eyes rolling about in their sockets and his lips dribbling. "This is my naughty boy, called 27th since his rebirth. This was one of our respected, much-loved sons, one of our anointed, one of our fellow morsels, one of our brotherly taste buds on the great tongue of life."
Fui Song's voice chortled with laughter as he spoke, as though he knew the absurdity of the part he was playing and couldn't resist hamming it up.
"This splinter from our tree, this grain from our beets, this reprobate dared to run toward the seven times cursed vehicle of the vacuum. He spurned the gift of burden with which we honoured him. He chose to abandon us and flee across the sands when the alien enemy passed over us yesterday. He did not trust our salving grace, but turned instead to an instrument of darkness and nothingness toward the soaking shade of the soulless ones, the anathematics."
Fui Song looked at the man, still shaking on the post across the fire from Hawser. The prophet's face went stern with reproach.
"By the workings of fate, the traitor who ran from our side and put his prophet's life at risk was caught, so that he might learn his sad mistake and make good his terrible crime."
Fui Song's arm dropped. The vast head shook. Mr. First shouted to the people round the fire. They faced the young man called 27th and chanted. The ghastly smells Hawser had sensed earlier came back, making his eyes mist and his nose tingle. While the people chanted and Fui Song watched, Mr. First and two of the women followers dug up small sacks from the sand. Out of them, they brought some thin lengths of cloth, which they proceeded to wrap round their bodies. As Mr. First put his vestments on, Hawser saw a large, cumbersome-looking projectile pistol held in a string holster beneath the man's grubby tunic. Hawser presumed that was the gun fired at the shuttle the day before when he and Mip had overflown the island. The young man opened his eyes, saw the three people in their cloths, and started screaming.
Hear how the stricken soul cries out for its lesson, pleads for its bounty of regret, its solace of refreshing suffering.
Fuisong smiled, looking at Hawser.
Ah, child, 27th knows what awaits him, and while his body, already proved so weak, breaks before the storm, his soul cries out, yes, yes, mighty prophet, succour me, make me part of you, give me your strength, come to me. Is it not a sweet and uplifting sound?
Hawser looked into the prophet's eyes and said nothing. The young man went on screaming and trying to tear himself away from the stump. Mr. First was crouched before him, on his knees, his head bowed, muttering to himself. The two women dressed in the dull cloth were preparing bowls of steaming liquid from the vats and pots around the fire, warming some over the flames. The smells came to Hawser, turning his stomach. Fuisong switched to the other language and spoke to the two women. They looked at Hawser, then came up to him with the bowls. Hawser drew his head away as they shoved the containers under his nose. He wrinkled his face up in disgust at what looked and smelled like fish entrails in a source of excrement. The women took the awful stuff away. It left a stink in his nose. He tried breathing through his mouth. The young man's mouth had been wedged open with blocks of wood, and his choking screams altered in pitch. While Mr. First held him, the women ladled the liquids from the bowls into his mouth. The young man spluttered and wailed, choked and tried to spit. He moaned, then threw up.
"Let me show you my armory, my benefaction," Fuisong said to Hawser, and reached behind his vast body.
He brought back a large bundle of rags, which he started to unfold. Glittering in the sunlight, metal devices like tiny man-traps were revealed. Fuisong put one finger to his lips while he surveyed the collection, then picked up one of the small metal contraptions. He put it into his mouth, fitting both parts over the pins Hawser had seen earlier.
Yeah,
Fuisong said, raising his mouth in a broad smile toward the changer.
What do you think of that?
The artificial teeth sparkled in his mouth, rows of sharp, serrated points.
Oh, jeez.
Fuisong swapped them for another set, full of tiny fangs like needles, then another with angled teeth like hooks with barbs, then another with holes set in them.
Good, eh?
He smiled at Hawser, leaving the last pair in. He turned to Mr. First.
Ah, you think, Mr. First, is?
Or? Fuisong took out the set with the holes, put in another set, like long blade-like spades.
Jeez. I ink eager and ash, yes. What a start this is. Let's harness those naughty touches.
27th's voice was becoming hoarse. One of his legs was lifted out in front of him and held by four kneeling men. Fuisong was lifted and carried on the litter to just in front of the young man. He bared the blade teeth, then leaned forward and with a quick nodding motion bit off one of 27th's toes. Hawser looked away. In the next half hour or so of leisurely paced eating, the enormous prophet nibbled at various bits of 27th's body, attacking the extremities and the few remaining fat deposits with his various sets of teeth. The young man gained fresh breath with each new sight of butchery. Hawser watched and didn't watch, sometimes trying to think himself into a kind of defiance that would let him work out a way to get back at this grotesque distortion of a human being. At other times, just wanting the whole awful business to be over and done with. Fuisong left his ex-disciple's fingers until last, then used the teeth with the holes in them like wire strippers.
Ey, Esti,
he said, wiping his blood-stained face with one gigantic forearm. 27th was cut down, moaning, covered in streaks of blood and only semi-conscious. He was gagged with a length of rag, then pinned down flat, face up on the sand. Wooden spikes through the palms of his mangled hands and a huge boulder crushing his feet. He started screaming weakly again through the gag when he saw the prophet Fui Song on his litter being carried over toward him. Fui Song was lowered almost on top of the moaning form. Then he struggled with some cords at the side of his litter until a small flap under his great bulk flopped open over the face of the gagged, blood-spattered human on the sand beneath. The prophet gave a sign, and he was lowered on top of the man, quieting the sound of moaning. The prophet smiled and settled himself with little movements of his huge body, like a bird nestling down over its eggs. His vast bulk obliterating all trace or shape of the human under him. Fui Song hummed to himself while the emaciated crowd looked on, singing very slowly and quietly, swaying together as they stood. Fui Song started to rock backward and forward softly, very slowly at first, then faster as sweat appeared in beads on the golden dome of his face. He panted and made a rough gesture toward the crowd. The two women dressed in the lengths of cloth came forward and started to lick at the trickles of blood which had spilled from the prophet's mouth, over the folds of his chins and down the expanse of his chest and breasts like red milk. Fui Song gasped, seemed to sag and stay still for a moment, and then, with a surprisingly fast and fierce motion, clouted both the lapping women across the head with his mighty arms. The women scurried off, rejoining the crowd. Mr. First started a louder chant, which the others took up. At last, Fui Song ordered himself to be lifted again. The litter-bearers hauled his massive frame into the air to reveal the crushed body of 27th, his moaning silenced forever. They lifted him out, beheaded the corpse, and removed the top of the skull. They ate his brains, and it was only then that Horsa threw up.
"And now we are become each other," Fui Song intoned solemnly to the youth's hollow head,
then threw its bloody bowl over his shoulder into the fire. The rest of the body was taken down to the sea and thrown in.
"Only ceremony and the love of fate distinguish us from the beasts, O mark of fate's devotion,"
Fui Song warbled to Horsa, as the prophet's vast body was cleaned and perfumed by the attendant women. Tied to his post, stuck in the ground, his mouth fouled, Horsa breathed carefully and deliberately, and did not try to reply. 27th's body floated slowly out to sea. Fui Song was toweled down. The skinny humans sat about listlessly or tended the awful-smelling liquid in the bubbling vats. Mr. First and his two women helpers took off their lengths of cloth, leaving the man in his grimy but whole tunic and the women in their tattered rags. Fui Song had his litter placed on the sand in front of Horsa.
"Sea burnt here from the waves, harvest from the rolling ocean. My people prepare to break their fast."
The prophet swept one fat, wobbling arm about to indicate the people tending the fires and cauldrons. The smell of rotting food filled the air.
"They eat what others leave, what others will not touch, because they want to be closer to the fabric of fate. They eat the bark from the trees, and the grass from the ground, and the moths from the rocks. They eat the sand, and the leaves, and the roots, and the earth. They eat the shells and the entrails of sea animals, and the carrion of the land and the ocean. They eat their bodily products and share mine. I am the fount, I am the wellspring, the taste on their tongues. You, bubble of froth on the ocean of life, are a sign. Crop of the ocean, you will come to see before the time of your unmaking that you are all you have eaten, and that food is merely undigested excrement. This I have seen, this you will see."
One of the attendant women came back from the sea with Hui Song's freshly cleaned sets of teeth. He took them from her and put them in the rags somewhere behind him.
"All shall fall but we. All go to their deaths, their unmakings. We alone will be made in our unmaking, brought into the glory of our ultimate consummation."
The prophet sat smiling at Horsa, while around him, as the long afternoon's shadows drew out across the sands, the emaciated, ill-looking people sat down to their foul meals. Horsa watched them try to eat. Some did, encouraged by Mr. First, but most could keep nothing down. They gasped for breath and gulped at the liquids, but often as not they vomited up what they'd just forced down. Fui Song looked on them sadly, shaking his head.
You see, even my closest children are not ready yet. We must pray and entreat that they are ready when the time comes, as it must in a few days' time. We must hope that their body's lack of grasp of sympathy with all things will not make them despised in the eyes and mouth of God.
You fat bastard. You're within range. If you only knew, I could blind you from here, spit in your little eyes, and maybe... But, Horsa thought, maybe not. The giant's eyes were set so deep within the flabby skin of his brows and cheeks that even the venomous spittle with which Horsa could have hit the golden monster might not find its way to the membranes of the eye. But it was all Horsa could find to give him solace in his situation. He could spit at the prophet, and that was it. Perhaps there would come a point when it might make some difference, but to do it now would be stupid. A blind, enraged Fuisong struck Horsa as something to try to avoid even more than a sighted, tittering one. Fuisong talked on to Horsa, never questioning, never really stopping, repeating himself more and more often. He told him about his revelations and his past life, as a circus freak, then as a palace pet for some alien satrap on a megaship, then as a convert to a fashionable religion on another megaship. His revelation occurring there, when he persuaded a few converts to join him on an island to await the end of all things. More followers had arrived when the culture announced what the fate of the Vavach orbital was going to be. Horsa was only half listening, his mind racing as he tried to think of a way out.
We await the end of all things, the last day. We prepare ourselves for our final consummation by mixing the fruits of earth and sea and death with our fragile bodies of flesh and blood and bone. You are our sign, our aperitif, our sink. You must feel honoured.
Mighty prophet, Horsa said, swallowing hard and doing his best to keep his voice calm. Fuisong stopped talking, the eyes narrowing still further and a frown forming. Horsa went on. I am indeed your sign. I bring you myself. I am the follower, the disciple numbered last. I come to rid you of the machine from the vacuum. Horsa looked over at the culture shuttle, sitting with its rear doors open at the far end of the beach. I know how to remove this source of temptation. Let me prove to you my devotion by performing this small service for your great and majestic self. Then you will know I am your last and most faithful servant, the one numbered last, the one come before the unmaking to steal your followers for the test to come and remove the anathematic temptation device. I have mixed with the stars and the air and ocean, and I bring you this message, this deliverance. Horsa stopped there, his throat and lips dry, his eyes running as the highly spiced stench of the eater's food drifted on a light breeze around him. Fuisong sat quite still on his litter, looking into Horsa's face with his slit eyes narrowed and his bulbous brows creased.
Mr. First, Fuisong said,
turning to where the pale-skinned man in the tunic was massaging one of the eater's bellies while the unfortunate follower lay moaning on the ground. Mr. First rose and came over to the giant prophet, who nodded at Horsa and spoke in the language the changer couldn't understand. Mr. First bowed slightly, then went behind Horsa, taking something from under his tunic as he went out of the changer's field of view. Horsa's heart thudded. He looked desperately back at Fuisong. What had the prophet said? What was Mr. First going to do? Hands appeared over Horsa's head, gripping something. The changer closed his eyes. A rag was tied tightly over his mouth. It smelled of the foul food. His head was forced back against the stake. Then Mr. First went back to the prone, groaning eater. Horsa stared at Fuisong, who said,
There. Now, as I was saying...
Horsa didn't listen. The fat prophet's cruel faith was little different from a million others. Only the degree of its barbarity made it unusual in these supposedly civilized times. Another side effect of the war, maybe. Blame the culture. Fuisong talked, but there was no point in listening. Horsa recalled that the culture's attitude to somebody who believed in an omnipotent god was to pity them, and to take no more notice of the substance of their faith than one would take of the ramblings of somebody claiming to be emperor of the universe. The nature of the belief wasn't totally irrelevant. Along with a person's background and upbringing, it might tell you something about what had gone wrong with them, but you didn't take their views seriously.
That was the way Horza felt about Fuisong. He had to treat him as the maniac he obviously was. The fact that his insanity was dressed in religious trappings meant nothing. No doubt the culture would disagree, claiming that there was ample common ground between insanity and religious belief, but then what else could you expect from the culture? The Adirans knew better, and Horza, while not agreeing with everything the Adirans stood for, respected their beliefs. Their whole way of life, almost their every thought, was illuminated, guided and governed by their single religion philosophy, a belief in order, place and a kind of holy rationality. They believed in order because they had seen so much of its opposite, first in their own planetary background, taking part in the extraordinarily fierce evolutionary contest on Idir, and then, when they finally entered into the society of their local stellar cluster, around them, between and among other species. They had suffered because of that lack of order. They had died by the millions in stupid, greed-inspired wars in which they became involved through no fault of their own. They had been naive and innocent, over-dependent on others thinking in the same calm, rational way they always did. They believed in the destiny of place. Certain individuals would always belong in certain places, the high ground, the fertile lands, the temperate isles, whether they had been born there or not. And the same applied to tribes, clans and races, and even to species. Most of the ancient holy texts had proved sufficiently flexible and vague to cope with the discovery that the Adirans were not alone in the universe. The texts which had claimed otherwise were promptly ditched, and their authors were first ritually cursed and then thoroughly forgotten. At its most mundane, the belief could be expressed as the certainty that there was a place for everything, and everything ought to be in its place. Once everything was in its place, God would be happy with the universe, and eternal peace and joy would replace the current chaos. The Adirans saw themselves as agents in this great reordering. They were the chosen, at first allowed the peace to understand what God desired, and then goaded into action rather than contemplation by the very forces of disorder they gradually understood they had to fight. God had a purpose beyond study for them. They had to find their own place, in the whole galaxy at least, perhaps even outside that as well. The more mature species could look to their own salvation. They had to make their own rules and find their own peace with God, and it was a sign of his generosity that he was happy with their achievements, even when they denied him. But the others, the swarming, chaotic, struggling peoples, they needed guidance. The time had come to do away with the toys of self-interested striving. That the Adirans had realized this was the sign of it. In them, and in the word that was their inheritance from the divine, the spell within their genetic inheritance, a new message was abroad. Grow up. Behave. Prepare. Horza didn't believe in the Adirans' religion any more than Balveda had, and indeed, he could see in its over-deliberate, too-planned ideals exactly the sort of life-constricting forces he so despised in the culture's initially more benign ethos. But the Adirans relied on themselves, not on their machines, and so they were still part of life. To him, that made all the difference. Horza knew the Adirans would never subdue all the less developed civilizations in the galaxy. Their dreamed day of judgment would never come. But the very certainty of that ultimate defeat made the Adirans safe, made them normal, made them part of the general life of the galaxy. Just one more species, which would grow and expand, and then, finding the plateau phase all non-suicidal species eventually arrived at, settle down. In 10,000 years, the Adirans would be just another civilization getting on with their own lives. The current era of conquests might be fondly remembered, but it would be irrelevant by then, explained away by some creative theology. They had been quiet and introspective before, so they would be again. In the end, they were rational. They listened to common sense before their own emotions. The only thing they believed without proof was that there was a purpose to life, that there was something which was translated in most languages as God, and that God wanted a better existence for his creations. At the moment, they pursued this goal themselves, believed themselves to be the arms and hands and fingers of God, but when the time came, they would be able to assimilate the realization that they'd got it wrong, that it was not up to them to bring about the final order. They would themselves become calm. They would find their own place. The galaxy and its many and varied civilizations would assimilate them. The culture was different. Horza could see no end to its policy of continual and escalating interference. It could easily grow forever, because it was not governed by natural limitations. Like a rogue cell, a cancer with no off-switch in its genetic composition, the culture would go on expanding for as long as it was allowed to. It would not stop of its own accord, so it had to be stopped. This was a cause he had long ago decided to devote himself to, Horsa told himself, listening to Fuisong droning on. Also a cause he would serve no more if he didn't get away from the eaters. Fuisong talked for a little longer, then, after a word from Mr. First, had his litter turned round so that he could address his followers. Most of them were either being very ill or looking it. Fuisong switched to the local language, Horsa didn't understand, and gave what was evidently a sermon. He ignored the occasional bout of vomiting from his flock. The sun dipped lower over the ocean, and the day cooled. The sermon over, Fuisong sat silently on his litter as, one by one, the eaters came up to him, bowed and spoke earnestly to him. The prophet's dome-like head wore a large smile, and every now and again it would nod with what looked like agreement. Later, the eaters sang and chanted while Fuisong was washed and oiled by the two women who had helped officiate at 27th's death. Then his vast body gleaming in the rays of the falling sun, Fuisong was carried, waving cheerfully, off the beach and into the small forest beneath the island's single stunted mountain. Fires were stoked, and wood was brought. The eaters dispersed to their tents and campfires, or set off in small groups with crudely made baskets, apparently to gather fresh debris they would later try to eat. At about sunset, Mr. First joined the five quiet eaters, who sat around the fire Horsa was by now tired of facing. The emaciated humans had taken little or no notice of the changer, but Mr. First came and sat near the man tied to the post. In one hand, he held a small stone. In the other, some of the artificial teeth Fuisong had used on 27th earlier that day. Mr. First sat grinding and polishing the teeth while he talked to the other eaters. After a couple of them had gone to their tents, Mr. First went behind Horsa and undid the gag. Horsa breathed through his mouth to get rid of the stale taste and exercised his jaw. He shifted, trying to ease the accumulating aches in his arms and legs.
"Comfortable?" Mr. First said, squatting down again.
He continued to sharpen the metal fangs. They flickered in the firelight.
"I felt better," Horsa said. "You'll feel worse too, friend."
Mr. First made the last word sound like a curse.
"My name's Horsa. I don't care what your name is."
Mr. First shook his head.
"Your name doesn't matter. You don't matter."
"I had started to form that impression," Horsa admitted.
"Oh, had you?" Mr. First said.
He got up and came closer to the changer.
"Had you really?"
He lashed out with the steel teeth he held in his hand, catching Horsa across the left cheek.
"Think you're clever, eh? Think you're gonna get out of this, do you?"
He kicked Horsa in the belly. Horsa gasped and choked.
"See? You don't matter. You're just a hunk of meat. That's all anybody is, just meat. And anyway," he kicked Horsa again, "pain isn't real. Just chemicals and electrics and that sort of thing, right?"
"Oh,"
Horsa croaked, his wounds aching briefly.
"Yes, right."
"Okay,"
Mr. First grinned.
"You remember this tomorrow, okay? You're just a piece of meat, and the prophet's a bigger one."
"You, don't believe in souls, then?"
Horsa said diffidently, hoping this wouldn't lead to another kick.
"Fuck your soul, stranger."
Mr. First laughed.
"You'd better hope there's no such thing. There's people that are natural eaters, and are those that are always going to get eaten. And I can't see that their souls are going to be any different, so as you're obviously one of those that are always going to get eaten, you'd better hope there isn't any such thing. That's your best bet, believe me."
Mr. First brought out the rag he had taken from Horsa's mouth. He tied it back there, saying,
"No, no soul at all would be the best thing for you, friend. But if it turns out you have got one, you come back and tell me, so I can have a good laugh, right?"
Mr. First pulled the knotted rag tight, hauling Horsa's head against the wooden stake. Fuisong's lieutenant finished sharpening the sets of gleaming metal teeth, then rose and spoke to the other eaters sitting around the fire. After a while, they went to some of the small tents, and soon they were all off the beach, leaving only Horsa to watch the few dying fires. The waves crashed softly on the distant surf line. Stars arced slowly above, and the dayside of the orbital was a bright line of light overhead. Shining in the starlight and the O-light, the silent, waiting bulk of the culture shuttle sat, its rear doors open, like a cave of safe darkness. Hawser had already tested the knots restraining his hands and feet. Shrinking his wrists wouldn't work. The rope, twine or whatever they had used, was tightening very slightly all the time. It would just take up the slack as quickly as he could produce it. Perhaps it shrank when drying, and they'd wet it before tying him. He couldn't tell. He could intensify the acid content in his sweat glands where the rope touched his skin, and that was always worth a try. But even the long night of Vavach probably wouldn't give enough time for the process to work. Pain isn't real, he told himself. Crap. He awoke at dawn, along with several of the eaters, who walked slowly down to the water to wash in the surf. Hawser was cold. He started shivering as soon as he woke, and he could tell that his body temperature had dropped a long way during the night in the light trance required for altering the skin cells on his wrists. He strained at the ropes, testing for some give, the slightest tearing of fibres or strands. There was nothing. Just more pain from the palms of his hands, where some sweat had run down onto skin unchanged and therefore unprotected from the acid his sweat glands had been producing. He worried about that for about a second, recalling that if he was ever to impersonate Craiklin properly, he would need to lift the man's finger and palm prints and so would need his skin in perfect changing condition. Then he laughed at himself for worrying about that when he wasn't even likely to see the day out. He vaguely considered killing himself. It was possible, with only a little internal preparation. He could use one of his own teeth to poison himself. But while there was still any chance, he could not bring himself to think of it seriously. He wondered how culture people faced the war. They were supposed to be able to decide to die too, though it was said to be more complicated than simple poison. But how did they resist it, those soft, peace-pampered souls? He imagined them in combat, auto-euthanizing almost the instant the first shots landed, the first wounds started to appear. The thought made him smile. The Adirans had a death trance, but it was only for use in cases of extreme shame and disgrace, or when a life's work was completed or a crippling disease threatened. And unlike the culture, or the changers, they felt their pain to the full, undampened by gene-affixed inhibitors. The changers regarded pain as a semi-redundant hangover from their animal evolution. The culture was simply frightened of it, but the Adirans treated it with a sort of proud contempt. Hawser looked across the beach, over the two big canoes toward the open rear doors of the shuttle. A pair of brightly coloured birds were strutting around on its top, making little ritualised movements. Hawser watched them for a while, as the eaters' camp gradually woke up and the morning sun brightened. Mist rose from the thin forest, and there were a few clouds high up in the sky. Mr. First came yawning and stretching out of his tent, then took the heavy projectile pistol out from under his tunic and fired it in the air. This seemed to be a signal for all the eaters to wake and set about their daily business, if they hadn't already done so. The noise of the crude weapon frightened the two birds on the roof of the culture shuttle. They took to the air and flew away over the trees and shrubs around the island. Hawser watched them go, then let his eyes drop, staring at the golden sand and breathing slow and deep.
"Your big day, stranger," Mr. First said with a grin, coming up to the changer.
He put the pistol into the string holster under his tunic. Hawser looked at the man but said nothing. "Another feast in my honour," he thought. Mr. First walked around Hawser, looking down at him. Hawser followed him with his eyes where he could, and waited for the man to spot whatever damage the acid sweat had succeeded in inflicting on the rope round his wrists. But Mr. First didn't notice anything, and when he reappeared in Hawser's view, he was still smiling slightly, nodding his head a little, seemingly satisfied that the man tied to the stake was still well enough restrained. Hawser did his best to stretch, straining at the bonds at his wrists. There was not even a hint of give. It hadn't worked. Mr. First left to supervise the launching of a fishing canoe. Fui Song was brought out of the forest on his litter not long before noon, as the fishing canoe was returning.
"Gift of the seas and air, tribute of the great Circle Sea's vast wealth, see what a wondrous day awaits you now."
Fui Song had himself brought up to Hawser and was put down to one side of the fire. He smiled at the changer.
All the night you have had time to think of what the day now holds. For all the darkness you have been able to look into the fruits of the vacuum. You have seen the spaces between the stars, seen how much there is of nothing, how little there is of anything. Now you can appreciate what an honour lies in store for you. How lucky you are to be my sign, my offering.
Fui Song clapped his hands with delight, and his enormous body shook up and down. The chubby hands went to his mouth as he spoke, and the folds of flesh over his eyes lifted momentarily to reveal the whites within.
Hoo-hoo! What fun we shall have!
The prophet made a sign, and his litter carriers took him down to the sea to be washed and anointed. Horsa watched the eaters prepare their food. They gutted the fish, throwing away the meat and keeping the offal and skins, heads and spikes. They removed the shells from the animals inside and threw the animals away. They ground up the shells with the weeds and some brightly coloured sea slugs. Horsa watched all this happen in front of him and saw just how run down the eaters really were. The scabs and sores, the deficiency diseases and general weakness. The colds and coughs, peeling skin and partly deformed limbs all spoke of a very gradually fatal diet. The dead meat and animals from the sea were returned to the waves via great blood-soaked baskets. Horsa watched as closely as his gag and the distance would allow, but none of the eaters seemed to take a surreptitious bite of the raw meat as they threw it from the baskets into the waves. Fui Song, being dried on the sand just up the beach from the line of breakers, watched the food being thrown into the sea and nodded with approval, speaking quiet words of encouragement to his flock. Then he clapped his hands, and the litter was slowly carried along the beach to the fire and the changer.
"Offer anything, benefaction, prepare yourself," Fui Song warbled, settling down in his litter with little movements which sent ripples all over the great folds and sweeps of his massive body.
Horsa started to breathe harder, felt his heart pound. He swallowed and strained again at the rope holding his hands. Mr. First and the two women were digging at the sand for the thin robes in their buried sacks. All the eaters gathered round the fire facing Horsa. Their eyes looked blank or vaguely interested, nothing more. There was a listlessness about their actions and expressions which Horsa found even more depressing than outright hatred or sadistic glee would have been. The eaters began to chant and sing. Mr. First and the two women were twisting the dull lengths of cloth around their bodies. Mr. First looked at Horsa and grinned.
"Oh, happy moment in the ending days," Fui Song said, raising his voice and hands, his choked tones ringing out toward the centre of the island.
The smells of the eater's foul cooking drifted past the changer again.
"Let this one's unmaking and making be a symbol for us,"
Fui Song continued, letting his arms drop back in enormous rolls of white flesh. The golden-brown surfaces gleamed in the sunlight as the prophet clasped his fat fingers together.
"Let his pain be our delight, as our unmaking shall be our joining. Let his flaying and consummation be our satisfaction and delectation."
Fui Song raised his head and spoke loudly in the language the others understood. Their chanting altered and grew louder. Mr. First and the two women approached Horsa. Horsa felt Mr. First take the gag from his mouth. The pale-skinned man spoke to the two women, who went to the bubbling vats of stinking liquid. Horsa's head was feeling very light. There was a taste he knew too well at the back of his throat, as though some of the acid from his wrists had somehow found its way to his tongue. He strained again at his bonds behind him, feeling the muscles shake. The chanting went on. The women were ladling the foul broth into bowls. His empty stomach was churning already. "There are two main ways to escape bonds, apart from those open to non-changers," the Academy's lecture notes said. "By acid sweat pulse on a sustained level, where the binding material is susceptible to such an attack, and by malleable preferential tapering of the limb point involved." Horsa tried to coax a little more strength from his tired muscles. "Excessive acid sweating can damage not only the adjacent skin surfaces, but also the body as a whole through dangerously altered chemical imbalances. Overmuch tapering poses the risk of the muscles being so wasted and the bones so weakened that their subsequent use may be severely restricted in the short and long-term escape attempt." Mr. First was approaching with the wooden blocks he would fit into Horsa's mouth. A couple of the larger eaters had stood up near the front of the crowd and advanced slightly, ready to assist Mr. First. Fui Song was reaching behind his back. The women started forward from the bubbling vats.
"Open wide, stranger," Mr. First said, holding out the two wooden blocks. "Or do we use a crowbar?"
Mr. First smiled. Hawser's arms strained. His upper arm moved. Mr. First saw the movement and halted momentarily. One of Hawser's hands jerked free. It shot round in an instant, nails ready to rake Mr. First's face. The pale-skinned man drew back, not quickly enough. Hawser's nails caught Mr. First's robe and tunic as they flapped out from his dodging body. Already straining as far out from the stake as he could, Hawser felt his clawed hand rip through the two layers of material without connecting with the flesh underneath. Mr. First staggered back, bumping into one of the women carrying the bowls of stinking gruel, knocking it from her hands. One of the wooden wedges sailed from Mr. First's hand and landed in the fire. Hawser's arm completed its swing just as the two eaters in front of the crowd came forward quickly and caught the changer by the head and arm.
"Sacrilege!"
Fui Song screamed. Mr. First looked at the woman he had bumped into, at the fire, at the prophet, then back with a furious look at the changer. He lifted one arm to look at the tears in his robe and tunic.
"The gift filth desecrates our vestments!" Fui Song shouted.
The two eaters held Hawser, pinning his arm back where it had been and his head to the stake. Mr. First started toward Hawser, taking the gun out from under his tunic and holding it by the barrel like a club.
"Mr. First!"
Fui Song snapped, stopping the pale-skinned man in his tracks.
"Stand, Gak! Hold Gat Arn out! You show this naughty guy how he gill is his shot!"
Hawser's free arm was straightened out in front of him. One of the eaters holding him put his leg round the back of the post, bracing himself there and trapping Hawser's other hand where it was. Fui Song had a set of gleaming steel teeth in his mouth, the hold ones. He glared at the changer while Mr. First stepped back, still holding the projectile pistol. The prophet nodded to another two eaters in the crowd. They took Hawser's hand and prized the fingers apart, tying that wrist to a pole. Hawser felt his whole body shake. He cut off all feeling in that hand.
"Naughty, naughty gist ran the sea," Fui Song said.
He leaned forward, buried Hawser's index finger in his mouth, closed the stripper teeth over them, cutting into the flesh, and then pulled quickly back. The prophet chewed and swallowed, watching the changer's face as he did so and frowning.
"Not very tasty, Gengagichin ran the ocean's currents."
The prophet licked his lips.
"I'm not sure enough of your Aisha, so it had seen. Let's see, what else ye can?"
Fui Song was frowning again. Hawser looked past the eaters holding him to the hand, stretched out of the pole, one finger stripped bare, the bones limp, blood dripping from the thin tip. Beyond that, Fui Song sat frowning on his litter on the sand. Mr. First, near his side, still glaring at Hawser and holding the gun barrel. As Fui Song's silence continued, Mr. First looked at the prophet. Fui Song said,
"Not as ni can.
Fui Song reached up and took the stripper teeth with some difficulty from his mouth. He laid them in front of him, with the rest on their rag, and put one pudgy hand to his throat, the other onto the vast hemisphere of his belly. Mr. First looked on, then back at Hawser, who did his best to smile. The changer opened his teeth glands and sucked poison.
"Mr. First,"
Fui Song began, then put out the hand on his belly toward the other man. Mr. First seemed uncertain what to do. He transferred the gun from one hand to the other and took the prophet's offered hand with his free one.
I think I,
Fui Song said, as his eyes started to open from slits to small ovals. Hawser could see his face changing colour already. Soon the voice as the vocal cords react.
"Help me, Mr. First."
Fui Song took hold of a lump of fat round his throat as though trying to undo a scarf tied too tightly. He stuck his fingers into his mouth, down his throat, but Hawser knew that wouldn't work. The prophet's stomach muscles were already paralysed. He couldn't vomit the poison up. Fui Song's eyes were wide now, glaring white. His face was going grey-blue. Mr. First was goggling at the prophet and still holding his huge hand. His own was buried somewhere inside the great golden fist of Fui Song's.
"Help!"
squeaked the prophet. Then nothing but choking noises. The white eyes bulged, the vast frame shook, the dome head went blue.
Somebody in the crowd started screaming. Mr. First looked at Hawser, then brought up the big pistol. Hawser tensed, then spat with all his might. The spittle splashed across Mr. First's face from mouth to one ear in a sickle shape, which just took in one eye. Mr. First staggered back. Hawser breathed in, sucked more poison, then spat and blew at the same time, landing a second burst of spittle right across Mr. First's eyes. Mr. First clutched at his face, dropping the gun. His other hand was still caught in Fuisong's grip as the obese prophet shook and quivered, his eyes wide but seeing nothing. The people holding Hawser wavered. He could feel it in them. More people in the crowd were crying out. Hawser jerked his body and snarled, spitting again at one of the men holding the pole his hand was tied to. The man screamed shrilly and fell back. The others let go of him or the pole and ran. Fuisong was going blue from the neck down, still quivering and clutching his throat with one hand and Mr. First with the other. Mr. First was on his knees, his face lowered, moaning as he tried to wipe the spittle from his face and remove the unbearable burning from his eyes. Hawser looked round quickly. The eaters were watching either their prophet and his chief disciple, or him, but they weren't doing anything either to aid them or to stop him. Not all of them were crying or screaming. Some were still chanting, quickly and fearfully, as though something they could say would stop whatever terrible things were happening. Gradually, though, they were backing off, away both from the prophet and Mr. First and from the changer. Hawser pulled and jerked his hand tied to the pole. It started to come free. Mr. First suddenly raised his head, hand clutching at one eye, and screamed for all his worth. His hand, still caught in that of the prophet, jerked out straight as he tried to pull free. Fuisong still held him in his grip, though, even as he quaked and stared and turned blue. Hawser's hand came free. He tugged at the bonds behind him and did his best with the crippled free hand to untie the knots. The eaters were moaning now, some still chanting, but they were moving away. Hawser roared, partly at them, partly at the stubborn knots behind him. Several in the crowd ran. One of the women, dressed in the ragged vestment clothes, screamed, threw her bowl of gruel at him, missing him, then fell sobbing to the sand. Hawser felt the ropes behind him give. He got the other arm free, then one foot. He stood shakily, watching Fuisong gargle and choke, while Mr. First howled, shaking his head this way and that, pulling and swinging his gripped hand as though in some monstrous travesty of a handshake. Eaters were running for the canoes or the shuttle, or throwing themselves onto the sand. Hawser struggled free at last and staggered toward the grossly imbalanced duo of men linked by the hand. He plunged forward and grabbed the fallen pistol from the sands. As he knelt and then stood, Fuisong, as though suddenly seeing Hawser again, gave one last gurgling, gagging splutter of noise and tipped slowly toward the side Mr. First was pulling and tugging from. Mr. First fell to his knees again, still screaming as the venom seared the membranes of his eyes and attacked the nerves beyond. As Fuisong toppled and his arm and hand went slack, Mr. First looked up and round, in time to see through his pain the vast bulk of the prophet falling toward him. He howled once on an indrawn breath as he pulled his hand free at last from the now blue clump of chubby fingers. He started to rise to his feet, but Fuisong rolled over and crashed into him, knocking him to the sand. Before Mr. First could utter another sound, the immense prophet had fallen over his disciple, flattening him into the sand from head to buttocks. Fuisong's eyes closed slowly. The hand at his throat flopped across the sand and into the outer edge of the fire, where it started to sizzle. Mr. First's legs beat a tattoo on the sand just as the last of the eaters ran away, jumping tents and fires and racing for the canoes or shuttle or forest. Then the two skinny legs sticking out from under the prophet's body were reduced to spasms, and after a while they stopped moving altogether. None of their movements had succeeded in shifting Fuisong's huge body a centimetre. Hawser blew some sand off the clumsy-feeling pistol and moved upwind from the smell of the prophet's hand burning in the fire. He checked the gun, looking round the deserted stretch of beach, around the fires and tents. The canoes were being launched. Eaters were crowding into the culture shuttle. Hawser stretched his aching limbs, looked at his bare-boned finger, then shrugged, put the gun under one armpit, put his good hand round the set of bones, pulled and twisted. His useless bones snapped from their sockets and he threw them onto the fire. "Pain isn't real anyway," he told himself shakily, and started for the culture shuttle at a slow run. The eaters in the shuttle saw him coming straight toward them and started screaming again. They piled out. Some of them ran down the beach to wade out after the escaping canoes, others scattered into the forest. Horza slowed down to let them go, then looked warily at the open doors of the culture craft. He could see seats inside, up the short ramp, and lights and a far bulkhead. He took a deep breath and walked up the gentle slope of ramp into the shuttle.
"Hello,"
said a crudely synthesized voice. Horza looked around. The shuttle looked pretty well used and old. It was culture, he was fairly certain of that, but it wasn't as neat and spanking new as the culture liked its products to look.
"Why are those people so frightened of you?"
Horza was still looking round, wondering where and what to address. "I'm not sure," he said, shrugging. He was naked and still holding the gun, with only a couple of strips of flesh on one finger, though the bleeding had quickly stopped. He thought he must look a threatening figure anyway, but maybe the shuttle couldn't tell that. "Where are you? What are you?" he said, deciding to feign ignorance. He looked around in a very obvious manner, hamming up a display of looking forward through a door in the bulkhead to a control area forward.
"I'm the shuttle. It's Brain. How do you do?"
"Fine," Horza said. "Just fine. How are you?"
"Very well, considering, thank you. I haven't been bored at all. But it is nice to have somebody to talk to at last. You speak very good Moraine. Where did you learn?"
I did a course in it," Horza said. He did some more looking around. "Look, I don't know where to look when I talk to